Reseeding. A brief alternate history of the universe. Slide 1. Our solar system under the stasis. First epoch. Continents slide and drift, scurrying and scraping across the surface of the mantle. Lights flicker around the coastlines, strobing on and off in kiliyear cycles as civilizations rise and fall. In space, the swarm of orbital momentum transfer robots built from the bones of Ceres begin to cycle in and out, slowly pumping energy downwell to the Earth to drag it farther from the slowly brightening sun. Slide 2. Snapshot. Something unusual is happening. We zoom in on a 10,000-year slice, an eye-blink flicker of geological time. For millions of years beforehand, the Earth was quiet, its continents fallen dark in the wake of a huge burping hiccup of magma that flooded from the junction of the Cocos and Nazca continental plates. But now the lights are black, jewels sprinkled across the nighttime hemispheres of unfamiliar continents. Unusually, they aren't confined to the surface. Three diamond necklaces ring the planet in glory, girdling the equator in geosynchronous orbit. And floating beyond them, at the L1 Lagrange point betwixt Earth and Luna, sits the anomalous glowing maw of an unusually large time gate. The natives appear to be restless. Slide 3. A slow slide of viewpoint out to Jupiter orbit shows that the anomaly is spreading. Already some of the smaller Jovian moons are missing. Thebe and Amalthea have vanished, and something appears to be eating Himalaya. A metallic cloud of smaller objects swarms in orbit around Europa, pinpricks of light speckling their surface. Meanwhile, the shoals of momentum transfer bodies are thinning, their simple design replaced by numerous perversions of form and purpose. Still powered by light sails, the new vehicles carry exotic machines for harvesting energy from the solar wind and storing it as antimatter. Shuttles move among them like ants amidst an aphid farm, harvesting and storing their largesse as they swing out to Jupiter before dropping back in toward Mercury. Some of the hundreds of metal moons that orbit Europa are glowing at infrared wavelengths, their temperature suspiciously close to 300 degrees Kelvin. Against the planetary measure of the solar system, they are tiny, little bigger than the moons of Mars. But they're among the largest engineered structures ever built by the dreaming apes, faster than cities and more massive than pyramids. And soon they will start to move. Slide 4. 3,000 years pass. Earth lies dark and unpopulated once more, for humanity, as always, has gone extinct. Of the great works in Jupiter orbit, few traces remain. The great ships have gone. The shipyards have long since been deorbited into the swirling chaos of the gas giant's atmosphere, and the malformed, warped transfer bodies have been cannibalized and restored to their original purpose. 5 small moons have disappeared, and slowly healing gouges show the sites of huge mining works on Io and Europa. But by the time the stasis reseed Earth, 2/3 of a million years hence, even the slow resurfacing of Europa's icy call will have obscured the signs of industry. It may be thousands of years after that before anybody notices. Slide 5. 20 million years pass, and the galaxy slowly lights up with a glare of coherent light, waste energy from the communications traffic between the inhabited worlds. The first generation colonies have long since guttered into senescence and extinction. So have the third and fourth generations. Of the first generation, barely 1 in 5 prospered, but that was sufficient. Those that live spawn prolifically. Planets are common, rocky terrestrial bodies far from rare, and even some of the more exotic types, water giants, tide-locked rocky giants in orbit around red dwarfs, and others, are amenable to human purpose. Where no planets are available, life is harder, prone to sudden extinction events. Nobody survives the collapse of civilization aboard a space colony. But the tools and technologies of terraforming are well known, and best practice of a kind develops. Many of the dwellers have adapted to their new habitats so well that they're barely recognizable as primates anymore, or even mammals. Slide 6. 3 billion years pass. 2 huge glittering clouds of sentience fall through each other, a magnificently coordinated flypast of fleets of worlds meshing across the endless void. Shockwaves thunder through the gas clouds, and millions of massive, short-lived new stars ignite and detonate like firecrackers. The starburst is indeed enormous, but for the most part, the inhabited worlds are safe. Swarms of momentum transfer robots, their numbers unaccountable, work for millions of years ahead of and behind the event to direct the closest encounters. Emergent flocking rules and careful plans laid far in advance have steered colonies clear of the high-risk territories, marshaling brown dwarfs as dampers and buffers to redirect the tearaway suns. And both galaxies are talking to each other, for the expanding sphere of sentience now encompasses the entire local group. Earth is no longer inhabited in this epoch, but the precious Time Gate remains, an oracular hub embedded in a cluster of exotic artificial worlds, conducting and orchestrating the Dance of Worlds. There are now 100 million civilizations within the expanding bubble of intelligence, each with an average population of billions. They are already within an order of magnitude of the Stasis's ultimate population, and they are barely a thousandth of its age. The universe, it appears, has started to wake up. Slide 7. The crystal ball is clouded. The kindest lies. They walked along a twisting path between walls of shrubs and creepers, and a few short trees, growing from mounds of damp-smelling soil. The path appeared to be of old sandstone, shot through with seams of a milky rock-like calcite. Appearances were deceptive. "You played me like a flute," said Pierce. He held his hands behind his back, as was his wont, keeping an arm's reach aside from her.
"I did not!"
Her denial was more in hurt than in anger.
"I didn't know about this until you, recruited me."
Her boots scuffed a rock, leaning like a rotten tooth from the side of a herbaceous border. Tiny insects scuttled from her toes unnoticed.
"I was still in training, like you, when you were tapped for other things."
They walked in silence for a minute, uphill and around a winding corner, then down a flight of steps cut into the side of a low hill.
"If this is all simply an internal adjustment, why doesn't internal affairs shut everything down?" he asked. "They must know who is involved."
"They don't."
She shook her head.
"When you call in a request for a time gate, your phone doesn't say, 'By the way, this iteration of Pierce is a member of the opposition.' All of us were compliant. Once. If they catch us, they can backtrack along our history and undo the circumstances that led to our descent into dissidence. And sometimes we can catch and isolate them, put them in an environment where doubt flourishes. If they started unmaking every agent suspected of harboring disloyal thoughts, it would trigger a witch hunt that would tear Stasis apart. We're not the kind who'd go quietly. Hence their insistence on control, alienation from family, and other fixed reference points, complicity in shared atrocity. They aim to stifle disloyal thoughts before the first germination."
"Huh." They came to a fork in the path. A stone bench, stained gray and gently eroded by lichen, sat to one side.
"Were you behind the assassination attempt, then?"
"No."
She perched tentatively at one side of the bench.
"That was definitely internal affairs. They were after him, not you."
"Him?"
"The iteration of you that never stayed in the hegemony, never met Ziri, eventually drifted into different thoughts and met Yarrow again under favorable circumstances."
Pierce slowly turned around as she was speaking, but in every direction he looked, there was no horizon, just a neatly landscaped wall of mazes curving gently toward the zenith.
"It seems to me that they're out of control."
"Yes."
She became intent, focused, showing him her lecturer's face.
"All organizations that are founded for a purpose rapidly fill with people who see their role as an end in itself. Internal affairs are a secondary growth. If they ever succeed, there won't be anything left of the Stasis but internal affairs, everyone spying on themselves for eternity and a day, trying to preserve a single outcome without allowing anyone to ask why."
Not everything added up. Still thinking, Pierce sat down gingerly at the other side of the bench. Not looking at her, he said,
"I met Imad and Lila, Ziri's parents. How could they have survived? Everyone kills their own grandparents. It's the only way to get into the Stasis." "How did you survive your graduation?"
She turned and looked at him, her eyes glistening with unshed tears.
"You can be very slow at times, Pierce."
"What?"
"You don't have to abide by what they made you do, my love. Corrupt practices, the use of complicity in shared atrocities to bind new recruits to a cause. It was a late addition to the training protocol, added at the request of Internal Affairs. It may even be what sparked the first muttering of opposition. We've got the luxury of unmaking our mistakes. Even to go back, unmake the mistake, and not enter the stasis, despite having graduated. Agents do that sometimes, when they're too profoundly burned out to continue. They go underground. They run and cut themselves off. That's why there was no agent covering the hegemony period you landed in. They'd erase their history with the stasis, going into deep cover.
You said they. Are you by any chance trying to disown their action? He asked gently.
No.
Now she sounded irritated.
I regret nothing. She regrets nothing. Withholding the truth from you for all those years. Well, what would you have done if you'd known that your adoring Ziri, the mother of your children, was a deep cover agent of the opposition? What would you have done?
She reached across and seized his elbow, staring at him, searching for some truth he couldn't articulate.
I don't know.
His shoulders slumped.
All those years, you were under observation by other instances of yourself, sworn in service to Internal Affairs, reporting to Kafka, she pointed out. Honesty wasn't an option, not unless you can guarantee that all of those ghost instances would be complicit in keeping the secret from the moment you were recruited by the stasis.
That's why, back in college... The moment of enlightenment was shocking. Yarrow's mouth, seen for the first time, wide and sensual, the pale lips, his reaction. He looked across the bench, saw the brightness in her eyes as she nodded.
I'd never betray her. It happened more than once, according to the final library. They can make you betray anyone if they get their claws into you early enough. The only way to prevent it is to make a palimpsest of your whole recruitment into the stasis, to replace your conscript youth with a disloyal impostor from the outset, or to decline the invitation altogether and go underground.
But I... him... I'm not him, exactly. She let go of his elbow.
Not unless you want to be, my love.
Am I your love, or is he?
That depends which version of you you want to be.
You're telling me that essentially I can only be free of Internal Affairs if I undo what they made me do.
There's a protocol, she said, looking away. We can reactivate your phone. You don't have to reenlist in the stasis if you don't want to. There are berths waiting for all of us on the colony ships.
But that's just exchanging one sort of reified destiny for another, isn't it? Expansion in space instead of time. Why is that any better than, say, freeing the machines, turning over all the available temporal bandwidth to time-like computing to see if the wild-eyed prophets of artificial intelligence and ghosts uploaded in the machines were onto something after all? She looked at him oddly.
Do you have any idea how weird you can be at times?
He snorted. Don't worry. I'm not serious about that. I know my limits. If I don't do this thing we're discussing, him upstairs will be annoyed. Because Kafka will have all those naively young loyal potential me's to send on spy missions, won't he? Pierce took a deep breath. I don't see that there's any alternative, really. And that's what rankles. I had hoped that the opposition would be willing to give me a little more freedom of action than Kafka, that's all. He felt the ghostly touch of a bunch of raisin-wrinkled grape joints holding in his preteen wrists, showing him how to cast a line. He owed it to Grandpa, he felt, to leave his own children a universe with elbow room unconstrained by the thumb cuffs of absolute history. Will you still be here when I get back? She regarded him gravely.
Will you still want to see me afterward?
Of course.
See you later, then.
She smiled as she stood up, then departed. He stared at the spot where she'd been sitting for what seemed like a long, long time. But when he tried to remember her face, all he could see was the two of them, Ziri and Yarrow, superimposed. Saying goodbye to now. 20 years in stasis. Numerous deaths, many of them self-inflicted, ordered with the callous detachment of self-appointed gods. They feed into the unquiet conscience of a man who knows he could have been better, can still be better, if only he can untangle the Gordian knot of his destiny after it's been tied up and handed to him by people he's coming to despise. That's you in a nutshell, Pierce. You're at a bleak crossroads, surrounded by lovers and allies, and oh, so isolated in your moment of destiny. Who are you going to be, really? Who do you want to be? All the myriad ways will lie before you, all the roads not taken at your back. Who do you want to be? You have met your elder self, the man-machine at the center of an intrigue that might never exist if Kafka gets his way, and you'll have mapped out the scope of the rift with Ziri, itself rooted in her despair at stasis. You can examine your life with merciless, refreshing clarity, and find it wanting if you wish. You can even unmake your mistakes. Let Grandpa Flower prune back your frightened teenage nightmare of murder. You can step off the murderous infinite roundabout whenever you please, resign the game, or rejoin and play to win. But the question you've only recently begun to ask is, who writes the rules? Who do you want to be? The snow falls silently around you as you stand in darkness, knee-deep in the frosted weeds lining the ditch by the railroad tracks. Alone in the night, a young man walks between islands of light. A headhunter stalks him unseen, another young man with a heart full of fears and ears stuffed with lies. There's a knife in his sleeve and a pebble-sized machine in his pocket, and you know what he means to do, and what will come of it. And you know what you need to do. And now it's your turn to start making history. Afterward, Palimpsest. Palimpsest wanted to be a novel. It really, really wanted to be a novel. Maybe it will be, someday. And maybe I could have gotten away with making it a short novel, just to round out this collection with an example of every format of fiction, if it wasn't for the imaginary voice of my editor nagging at the back of my head. Do you know how much it costs to print a hardcover once it goes over 500 pages? Part of the reason novels are the length they are is the cost of printing and binding. Binding a fat book is disproportionately more expensive than binding two thinner ones, and there is a downward pressure on the price of hardbacks, which makes it difficult for publishers to show a profit on a fat volume. No surprise, then, that many recent big fat fantasy novels have shown up split into two or more thinner volumes. Perhaps once publishing moves wholesale onto the internet, fashions in fiction length, and the disappearance of printing and binding costs will lead to more and longer novels. But in the here and now, this short story collection is pushing the limits of what I can get away with, without any need to add another 100,000 words.